Good evening, and welcome to yet another episode of The Last Knock. Your friends in horror since, has it been 1979, Billy?
Oh, I wish.
It sometimes feels like 1979.
Yeah, true. This is our 313th episode, so it's a long damn time.
How many episodes is that in light years, Bill?
I don't know, but we beat the Kessel run in like 5.2 parsecs. I was choking on my words. Like I'm trying to think Alan. Oh, I'm trying to fuck.
Whatever.
Just go.
Let's roll with it. I'm Johnny Numb, and joining me tonight, as always, co-piloting, as it were.
Co-piloting. We're going down, man. We're going down.
This doomed vessel already. Yeah.
Yeah, man. Breaking rocks for this mining company. Billy Crash.
Yeah, and that doesn't bode well for our spacefaring adventure tonight, so.
No.
Because we're talking about, drumroll please. Thank you, Billy.
Well, I just spit all over my microphone.
Are you sure that's not concentrated acid, Billy?
It could be.
We're talking about Ridley Scott's very little-known film, Alien, on the occasion of its 40th anniversary, which will be June 22nd.
Yeah!
And Billy, I know you have extremely strong feelings about this film. And actually, I do too. But maybe we can get the conversation rolling.
Yes.
With I'm curious, and maybe you've told this story before, but yes, if yes. You have, it could bear repeating. What was your first encounter with Alien?
My first encounter with Alien was about a year before it even came into theaters. I'm sure a lot of people remember Starlog magazine, you know, some of the older listeners, and they just had like article after article, it seemed, of Alien and concept pictures, and I read them all, and, you know, it's the first time I was introduced to H.R. Giger and his incredible artwork, and I'm just like, I instantly fell in love with this movie before I even saw a frame. And the wild thing is, the movie comes out, and all of these, I can't wait, and all of these stories start surfacing about this this one friggin' what was he? Usher in a theater during this one scene. He went unconscious, somebody threw up. So my parents hear enough of that and are like, son, we don't really think you're ready to, and I'm like, okay. And of course now you know, even then when I saw it like a year later or something like that, and you watch it today, it's like I can't imagine people getting sick over this, but so I've never seen it on the big screen.
Yeah, because I wasn't certain whether you did or you didn't. I think I'm getting that. I'm getting mixed up with The Thing, which you did see on the big screen.
Yes, I did.
Okay, that's cool. So you were kind of like sort of entrenched in kind of the pre-release hype, as it were, back at that time. That's cool.
Yeah, and the great thing was it all lived up to it.
My first experience with Alien, I believe, was seeing it on basic cable, or actually maybe some of the local stations would show it in a cut version.
Oh, that sucks.
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of like these were like back in the late 80s and early 90s, or just the 90s, where, you know, you could see those R-rated movies on basic cable, but they would cut out the naughty bits, cut out the bad words, of course, to make it acceptable for home viewing.
Whatever that means.
And I don't think I saw it properly until I watched it on my best friend's VHS. Yeah, a few years. Well, actually, I was probably well within high school at that time. And I think we just had a sleepover one night, and we both watched it. And I was not that kind of sleepover.
Oh, there was no pillow fights, Johnny?
No, it wasn't like dorm cam or anything like that. It was more like it was more like Lotus sleeping pod cam. I don't know.
Oh, geez. Wow, you guys are really exciting and hot.
But that was probably the first time I watched it from proper, from start to finish. And I was very taken with it. You know, it was weird because I feel like I'd seen Aliens prior to actually seeing Alien proper.
Oh, man, Aliens is awful.
Yeah, and I was like, we don't have to talk about the sequels. Tonight is all about Ridley Scott and what he achieved with this film, which I know you've said, Bill, that you feel it's, if not a perfect film, it's very close to a perfect film, and I'd be inclined to agree with that.
Yeah, you know what really gets me about the whole movie is, and in fact, I'm going to look up the gentleman's name right now because I don't want to butcher it. Where am I? I'm flying.
Aboard the Nostromo, Bill.
Yeah, Derek Van Lint, the director of photography.
Yes.
Oh, man, he killed it. I mean, and it sounds so weird. Like, my favorite scene in the movie is when Ripley puts her hand up, and you just see this focus on her hand and her long fingers as she's trying to, like, pull herself up out of a hole in the hall. And it's, I just loved it. I know it sounds like freaking like film school bullshit, but it was just great. You know, when she's just all sweaty and she's just like, this is it, man. Am I going to live or die? You know, I just loved it, man.
Is that near the end, Bill?
Yeah, definitely near the end when, and everybody, it's funny. Everybody talks about the cast, which is phenomenal. And we've lost several members of the cast.
Yeah.
You know, which is sad. You know, Harry Dean Stanton has passed, John Hurt, Ian Holm. But a lot of people forget the person who played the alien, not for the stunt scenes, but Balaji Badeo, the Nigerian, who passed away at 39 from sickle cell, which I know is a painful disease. That's just really awful.
Oh, jeez.
Helen Horton, who played Mother, the voice, loved that voice, man. I want, like, everybody's like talking about like Alexa and Siri and all this bullshit. I want Mother in my house. That's what I want.
You know what's perfect, Bill, just as an aside?
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking about the fact that the computer is called Mother and it has the voice of, I apologize for the phrase, the bitchy schoolmarm, basically.
Yeah, 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 exactly.
Especially at the end when Ripley calls her a bitch.
Oh yeah.
And it's this fantastic, you know, it's just a perfect moment. Yeah.
Turn on to cool it, Mother. and everybody, you know, doesn't remember this gentleman. In fact, he's uncredited. Eddie Powell. He's the gentleman who did the stunts in the alien costume, and we lost him in 2000. And it was funny because, you know, some kids will watch it today and they'll go, oh man, you can tell it's a guy in a suit. And Ridley Scott did not want that. He'd probably just punch them in the face today.
Yeah.
Because when one of a crew member found Balaji in a bar, and Balaji's 6'10" and really, really lanky. And it's like, oh man, he could fit in this suit because he wanted this suit to be like so like tight and intense that it's like, man, they couldn't get a guy in there. But
yeah.
You know, but they wormed. Balaji into it.
You know, Bill, and that's funny because I watched the movie. I know it's a guy in the suit, but while I'm watching the movie, I'm not thinking that's a guy in the suit. I'm thinking this is a creature with concentrated acid for blood who's going to really fuck you up if you get, you know, within a spitting distance of it.
Yeah, and again, you know, I attribute all of that to Ridley Scott, who you could see the footage and it looks absolutely awful, and that's why it's not included. And Ridley Scott was like, we're not doing this again, man. We're not. It's called The Crab Walk, and it has, like, you know, Balaji, like, you know, crawling on the ground, you know, in the suit, and it just looks hideous. And so he wanted to show like snippets of the beast, the monster, this uncanny alien that you face in just certain ways, shapes, and forms, so you would, again, you know, not be like, man, it's a guy in a suit. This is like an old, you know, Godzilla movie, you know?
Yeah, Well, and I think there's stuff that Ridley Scott does, Bill, in this film that I think makes the alien a lot more effective than it would have if it were handled differently. I feel like the lighting in this movie is extremely specific. It's a dark movie.
Oh, yeah.
There are so many scenes, like I'll throw out the example. And folks, if you haven't seen Alien yet, I think we're probably going to get into spoiler territory. So
Yeah, and
perhaps stop and come back.
if you haven't seen Alien already, what the hell's wrong with you? Anyway, go
Yeah.
ahead, Johnny.
Yeah, I mean, it's not due to a lack of availability, that's for sure.
Damn straight.
But I'm thinking of the scene where Captain Dallas is they're trying to flush the alien out of the air ducts, and he's in there with like a sort of a makeshift flamethrower and a flashlight and sort of a tracking device. It wasn't until I watched it just the other night that I was like, man, it feels like the scenes in these corridors, even at other points in the film, are solely lit by the items that are creating light in the vicinity of these locations.
I agree with you. The lighting is fantastic. It's almost like it has a noir feel to it.
Oh, kind of, yeah.
What I think is interesting is that pure white room, the dining area and the room in which they go to the sleeperinos. And it's white and it's just still doesn't feel right. And it just still feel it's like, wow, it's white, but it feels tainted. And it just they just had a great way of skewing it and making it, just have this ominous feeling.
Yeah, and I know I brought up the thing earlier, Bill. I noticed a couple things, and this can be another kind of tangent here, but there's some interesting, just slight trivia parallels here to the Carpenter version of the thing. Because who's Ripley, like once they wake up from the pods and they don't quite know what's going on because they think they're supposed to be in another place when they wake up, and they're not in that place. So Ripley's trying to raise the I got it in my notes here. It's the Antarctica Traffic Control Center on the communicator. Near the end of the film, when the self-destruct sequence has been initiated in the ship, you see Ripley going down corridors, and there's flames bursting out at random in the corridors, sort of like when MacReady and the other guys in the thing were throwing dynamite in each room and blowing up the camp, which was its kind of own form of self-destruction. And there was something else, and I'm sure I'll think of it at some point.
It's not our system. I know that.
Yeah.
That was beautiful, man.
Oh, no, the other thing, Bill, was I love how the film opens, and this is something that occurs throughout the movie, and I love how you are never ahead of the characters in this movie. And that is something that also shares with the thing and the way Ridley Scott creates this sense of disorientation right from the start. Like
And isolation.
once you get aboard that, once we start looking at the inside of that ship, after we find out what the crew number is, what the name of the ship is, that little title card.
Nostromo baby.
Yeah, and then you're just like looking down these corridors as the camera slowly pans. You don't see any people until that scene in the or the pod bay doors lift, and the characters wake up from hypersleep. And I think that's really ingenious because it's like you're completely disoriented and alienated, like you said, from the start, because it's like you have no idea what's happening or why it's happening. There's no convenient narrator saying, oh, well, aboard the Nostromo, these people have been sleeping and they're in for a surprise. Yeah. It's just like candid camera. Let's watch and see what happens. Yeah.
Oh man. Yeah, I love the whole beginning of it. I watch Alien at one point I was watching it once a month and I can't
Man.
tell you how many times I've seen it, but it's just It's funny because you're mentioning The Thing, and I never really thought about these elements that John Carpenter used later for The Thing that mirror some of what Ridley Scott did. But one of the things that I love about Alien, that I also love about Kubrick's The Shining, is the way the movie starts. It has this weird off feeling, but it's seemingly innocuous, and it's just so beautiful in a way that you just want to just kick back and just like enjoy this thing. In fact, Ridley Scott even said, well, nothing happens in a movie for the first 40 minutes.
He's kind
And
of right, yeah.
he's right, but I don't care. I just don't care. And if you've read the script, I read Dan O'Bannon's script. I love Dan O'Bannon. And of course, the story is also from Ronald Shusett, who went on to be an executive producer of the movie.
And they both worked on Dead and Buried together a couple years later.
Oh yeah, which I love. I love that movie. With it's funny in the script, like in the movie we're watching it, and they're showing these helmets. They're showing, and you hear this like buzz sound, and then like all these weird noises. Well, Dan O'Bannon wrote out those noises, man. He's using Z's and he's like doing all that. I'm like, son of a bitch, man. And I know he just came out of this wacky thing. He was slated to write Jodorowsky's
Yeah,
Dune,
dude. Yeah.
and he was living in a Paris hotel for like days and days on end, away from his family and all of that. And he was just like, I think, going bonkers in the bedroom, and
Yeah.
like, damn it, let me out of here. And so I think that had a lot to do with how Alien began and where it went. But yeah, it just conjures this like feeling, and it's like, all right, I need to stay glued to this, but it's different. It's funny what Star Wars did for science fantasy and science fiction films in general by like really upping their game with story as well as visuals. Alien really made it real. And the one thing I loved is, and it blew me away right from the beginning, is when these people start talking, it's like I can relate to them. It's not like, well, Captain Dallas, we're at the fourth quadrant and we need to go to, oh, don't worry, young pilot, we'll take, like none of that 50s shit, It was like, dude, where are we? I don't know. It's like, I want to get back to Earth and party. And it's like, we're not a rescue ship. We're not a rescue ship. It's like Yaphet Kotto's character Parker is just amazing. And it was just, I loved it. It was real and genuine. And whenever I, as a screenwriter, I always go to the one scene where they're trying to figure out how to kill the alien, with Parker and friggin' Ripley, not getting along and talking over each other. And I think it's just so natural and brilliant. I think for any movie that anybody is writing anywhere, this is the scene you want to watch because these actors killed it, destroyed it, owned it, and it came out off so genuine. That's part of the appeal of the movie. It's like, wow, alien on a spaceship. No, alien on a spaceship with real people, and that's a whole different thing.
Bill, I'm in total agreement, and that segues nicely into something I did want to bring up about the characters.
Cool, we did a segue. Yeah.
But I was thinking about this. We do not get any backstory whatsoever on these people, where they came from, what they're, we don't know what they did previously in life. There's no asides about rough childhoods or something like that. What we see is what we get. And I think it's brilliant that Ridley Scott brought together these actors. And I would say that, with maybe the exception of Tom Skerritt, none of the other actors would be able to like open a movie big at that time. Do you
Oh,
think
well,
that's
agreed.
Because Sigourney Weaver was just getting started.
Yeah, I mean, the first time a lot of people saw her was at the end of Annie Hall, I think, with the Woody Allen movie.
Yeah, and I mean, you'd seen Veronica Cartwright like the previous year in Invasion of the Body
I
Snatchers, and
love
that
her.
in that one Twilight Zone episode. She'd been around, but these were mostly character actors.
Oh,
Yaphet Kotto worked with Larry Cohen, and Harry
yep.
Dean Stanton worked with everybody, but he was not the
Yes.
lead. He was not the lead actor. He was
Nope.
not a lead. These were like these weird. They're kind of like the Bad News Bears of sci-fi
I
movies,
love it. Yeah, no,
basically.
perfectly stated, man. And it's funny because they're all so well recognized and respected now, and they've all had their. I don't know if Veronica Cartwright, was a lead in a film, but all the others ended up finding him, you know, leads. And Nyaffa Koto. I mean, most people know him from Homicide: Life on the Streets. You know, famed television show, which is absolutely brilliant, absolutely brilliant. And and he was great in that, as he is within everything else he did. So yeah, it was just excellent. And the way these, the way they they came together, the way they interacted with each other, I just thought it was great. And they all brought their own style, and created unique, distinct characters. Very idiosyncratic. It rocked.
Yeah, and you know what, Bill? It's strange because it's something I never really thought about when the previous times I've watched the film, and I've probably watched it not as much as you, but a fair amount of times at this point to be fairly familiar with most of what happens. Like, I found myself trying to kind of like affixing my own backstories to these characters the last time I watched it, like thinking like, well, you know, like, for example, Parker and Brett, in addition to being like fantastic comic relief, they're really the blue collar types. These are the guys who, you know, they hem and haw about because they're sort of like, they're not on the same, they weren't hired by the same people that hired the other crew.
Oh yeah.
And they keep going on and on like
subcontractors.
Yeah. But yeah, and we have that actually in state government, you know, we have contract staff who, you know, they have a higher paycheck, but they don't get as much leave, and they the benefits are crap. So, you know,
well, and it's about the bonus situation, Johnny.
Yeah, exactly. Billy, why don't you freeze him? Billy, why don't you freeze him?
If everybody had listened to Parker, none of this would have happened.
Well, you could even say that about Ripley keeping the door closed at the beginning of the movie.
Yeah. Open the goddamn door. We have to get him inside.
But I was thinking, okay, they're the blue collar guys. And like you said, Yaphet Kotto has the line, I want to go back to Earth and party.
Yeah. And rest are the pilots. We're the crew. We're the established crew. Thank you for flying the friendly Nostromo.
And I like how Dallas is a bit of like, he reminds me kind of some of the supervisors I've encountered working for the state. Because he's more of like, you know what, this is the mission. I gotta mediate and delegate and all this stuff. I don't necessarily want to do it, but I gotta do it. So do it, kind of thing.
Yeah. When do I retire? I've been doing this shit too fucking long, man.
Yeah, exactly. You can tell he's just like waiting out the days to collect his pension, kind of.
Yeah, and you know it was beautiful, and I don't know how much Ronald Shusett had to do with it, but with Dan O'Bannon, with the lingo that they incorporated in it. You know, it's like, you know, like even at the end, maybe the network will pick me up once I hit the outer rim type of thing. And it's like, this is just great stuff, you know. It's just unlike Aliens, where they're all from freaking Vietnam, but I fucking hate that movie. But
they were in hypersleep for a long damn time, Bill.
But with this is it was just really cool. There are a couple of things that I noticed that maybe don't make the movie as perfect as I had once hoped. In the beginning, when they show the one computer screen, and then they go back to the helmet, and then they go to the computer screen again. I'm always hoping, because if I love a movie, I have to try and justify things that might not appear correct. Right. But the coffee mug moves from one side to the other. So I'm hoping that they went to the other screen, and I'm thinking maybe they did. But the one thing that has always boggled my mind about the film, and I don't know of anyone who's brought this up, but in the beginning, when it's like they're going out to like check on this signal that they got, that's you know, a distress signal at first, or so they believe, you know, John Hurt's character, Kane, says, should we break out the weapons? And when it comes to fighting this alien thing, there are no weapons. And you could see promo pictures of like, you know, Parker and stuff, and they have like laser guns.
They do.
Yeah. So it's like, what happened?
Okay. All right.
You know, and it's like, I still can't come up with an answer to justify why they use these makeshift flamethrowers.
And Bill, I gotta say something. John
Sure.
Hurt's character in this movie, this is another person who I was attaching a backstory to. He is the most humorless motherfucker on board that ship, I gotta say. There's this great moment, okay, where
The
they're,
dining scene.
well, not the dining scene, but it's I think it's where I think they've landed on the planet or something. It's Kane, Lambert, and Dallas.
In Dallas,
Actually,
yeah.
I think it, no, I think it's Kane, Dallas, and Ash are all in the same shot. I think Ash says something that Dallas laughs at, and Kane just kind of looks at them like, "What's your problem?"
It's not
So
jumping into my brain.
it's kind of like, and he shows no real sense of humor until the face hugger falls off his face, and it feels like it's back to business when they're in the commissary eating in kind of a elliptical way to the beginning of the film.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah, like plug us in, all those lines. Like he's just like, let's do this. And when they're on a planet with Lambert and Dallas and Kane, when they're on a planet and Lambert's like, griping, and he's like, stop griping. Oh, I like griping. And Dallas is the one who's really has no sense of humor. He's like, knock it off. It's like,
Oh,
let's
yeah.
get there. Let's just get there, man. Let's just get in this damn thing. But then John Hurt, character, Kane, he's so inquisitive. He's like, we have to go on. We must go on. And it's like, oh, be careful what you wish for, man, because
That's true. It's sort of curiosity, and there is a
killed the
cat on
cane.
board. Killed the cane. Yeah.
Oh, man.
Yeah, so I think there's some interesting stuff that Ridley Scott does, Bill, that keeps the film that keeps the viewer guessing.
Yeah, because it's a mystery as well. People forget that. It's a
Oh
thriller,
yeah.
it's a mystery, it's horror, it's science fiction.
Yeah, because I think something he does to keep us guessing is, like, for example, when Lambert, Dallas, and Kane start walking on that planet and exploring. Ridley Scott keeps the camera in front of them, so we're watching them move toward us. So whatever they're bumping into, whatever they're stumbling across, again, we don't see it until one of them sees it. And
That's true.
even Ash, who's viewing it from a viewfinder on the ship, he's only seeing so much. He's keeping an eye on them.
Oh, yeah.
So he's only getting across whatever they're getting across. So it's kind of neat, and I love those methods that he keeps returning to that throughout the movie, like of keeping the camera slightly ahead of a character so you can't see what's around the corner.
Oh, man. Yeah,
So
I.
there's more unpleasant surprises to be had, and it works. It holds up to repeat viewings, I think.
Oh, yeah. An $11 million budget, Johnny.
That's insane. Even in 1979 dollars.
I know. I mean, your average shit, third-rate piece of crap horror movie, low budget is $4 million today.
Oh man. That's inconceivable.
Inconceivable. Yes, it is.
Yeah.
Oh man. The
Yes.
No, I was just trying to think of, obviously I saw the original theatrical version. And
Yes.
you did as well, and then, he did this revamped. His director's edits just always piss me off. So, I'd like to do a re-edit of the film and get the I want to keep I don't I didn't understand why he didn't play the sound, that creepy otherworldly sound of that distress signal, because it's bizarro. I mean, he should have kept that in the original
Okay.
release. But the scene with Dallas on the wall is just stupid. It needs to go.
You know what, Bill? I gotta say, I was thinking about that because I have the Blu-ray and it has both versions of the movie on
Yeah,
it.
same here. We have the same one, man.
Yeah, and I typically, actually, I'll usually watch the director's cut, but I decided to watch the theatrical version for a change of pace for the show. The one thing I will agree with you that the Dallas scene near the end, it doesn't work. And the reason it doesn't work and the reason it should have stayed cut was because Ridley is on a schedule, with the clock counting
Yeah,
down,
exactly.
and that seems like too much of a sidebar. It almost seems like more time is taken up with her just looking around the room and just like looking at Dallas before she decides to do the deed.
Kill me.
Yeah.
It's awful. It's fucking awful.
Yeah, so I mean, I kind of agree with you. That takes away from the urgency of what's happening. The ship's essentially going to blow the fuck up and you're going to stop for a couple minutes, what it feels like.
Well, in that regard, to that scene, I think that's originally why it was cut, because Ridley Scott was like, it doesn't belong here. But over the years, fans were going nuts about this missing footage. We have to see, it was like fan bullshit. And it's like sometimes, you should tell the fans to shut the fuck up, and you should have.
You know what's interesting, Bill? I think Scott actually came out and said he doesn't. In 2006, he said that he had been unhappy about the director's cut, feeling that the original was pretty flawless and that the additions were merely a marketing tool.
Agreed, but that sound though, that I would put in that's the scene I would have, and I would definitely keep that in there. And he also added that scene, which we really don't need, when Ripley's trying to figure out, like, she's suspicious of Ash, the science officer played by the late great Ian Holm, and she's like, oh, did you ever sleep with Ash? But we didn't, we don't need that either, but.
Yeah, actually, the one thing I do like that I miss in the theatrical version, Bill, it's in the director's cut, is the moment when Kane's in the infirmary with
Yes.
Dallas and
Yep.
Ash, and Veronica Cartwright comes storms in
It's beautiful.
and she slaps Ripley, and that is a great character moment right there.
Yeah, and I'm like, why the fuck did you cut that originally? That was so poignant and perfect. It was great. And that's one hell of a slap. I mean, Sigourney Weaver took a wallop, man.
You feel it,
Oh,
yeah.
man, yeah. I think Sigourney Weaver's still feeling it.
But I like that because it's a little bit of extra character there, and
Yes, exactly.
it establishes Lambert kind of as the, I don't, due to a lack of a better term, she's kind of the scaredy cat. She's crumbling emotionally, and whereas Ripley is more confident, and she's like trying to hold everybody together when things start to go to shit,
Yeah,
so
exactly.
it kind of establishes the dichotomy between the two female characters in the film, but also in how they interact with everybody else too. And I think that's just, I was just watching it the other night, and I was like, oh, I wish that moment were in the theatrical version.
Yeah, and that's why I always watch the new director's cut, and I try to just ignore the freaking.
Kill me.
Yeah, oh man. But I'm glad you brought up the fear factor, because one of the things I love about Ripley's character is she's not, and this is what was like abandoned later on to a degree, and she became a smarmy, smart ass. We called her Rambette when Aliens came out. She's Rambette, and but there was this great balance within her of she's scared, but she knows what she needs to do, and she's, I think, like. Being like anybody else who's strong, it's like those fear elements are there, but it's like if you give in to them, you're gonna die. And she really hung on, and that's why I think it's fantastic. Her character's just great. The transformation, she's strong in the beginning. I'm the third. I'm a lieutenant. I'm the third in charge of the ship. I'm following protocol. You're like, what the hell are we doing? Then shit gets ugly, and she's like, we gotta kill it. And remember, she's the one who volunteered to go into the air duct first. And Dallas said, no, I'm going. Because Dallas was like, ah, fuck it, I'm going. Lead by example, all that bullshit. Yeah, good move, Dallas. get out of there! And, I just loved how her character was like, man, this is really serious. This is ugly and nasty. I'm scared to death. And it was cool because, she had that great moment where, the dead face hugger falls on her shoulder and she just, freaks out, It's like, oh my God, it was just awesome.
Well, and I think that also
It's a great
ties into
scene.
the, yeah, I think that also ties into the very end, Bill, where she is
Lucky,
obviously,
lucky, lucky, lucky.
Yeah, the reality of the situation has like come like crashing down on her because she's the last one left.
Yep.
She's trying to get to that escape pod and get the hell out of there before the ship blows. And she is like sobbing and weeping because I think the gravity, pardon the pun, of everything is kind of coming down on top of her, and she's like, she is all alone. There's no one to defer to anymore. And for as much as she seems to wish that, I had this backstory for Ripley where she's like the kid who would play sports in gym class as a kid, and she would keep getting passed over regardless of how good she was
I like that.
at something. Because this is something you notice from the very start of the film. People are like rebuffing her, her suggestions, her commands, and well, here's what you reap, kind of. You're not following the quarantine protocol. You're letting this person in. They might be infected with God knows what, and we're all screwed, basically. So I really like that. And then that moment, that beautiful moment you mentioned, where Parker is just jabbering in the background, and Ripley is like, "Shut the!" She's basically like, "Shut the fuck up, Parker."
Does that mean killing it? Of course it means killing it. And I was like, oh, it's just freaking, it's gold, man. That whole scene.
Oh no, it's fantastic. And you don't even know what Parker's saying in the background. It's unintelligible the way it's mixed into the movie, and it doesn't have to be clear because it's just like Parker's been going off the whole goddamn movie. I don't blame Ripley for snapping at him.
Yeah, but he's in full frontal combat mode. I mean, it's really cool too because we get to see him freaked out because he's like, no, I could refill it myself, man. And he's all like nonchalant and cavalier. And as soon as he gets in the hallway, he's like doing these SWAT moves, man. He's like bouncing around and shit, you know. He's like, fuck, man, I don't want to die. Oh, it was awesome. It was just so real. But
Well, and,
while Ca Ash is collating, you know.
well, and what did you think? Let's talk a bit about Ashbill, and what how do you feel about because this is something Ridley Scott has returned to the well with in his prequel films, but we don't have to talk about them.
No,
How
pieces
do
of
you
shit.
think the reveal? I every time I watch the movie, I know Ash is a robot.
Right.
He's an android, but every time I watch it, I'm like, the reveal of that is so ingenious. How do you feel about the reveal of Ash in his true
Oh,
form?
I love it. And it's funny because without saying much, just like this makes perfect sense. You want to send something mechanical that's not going to get destroyed by this thing to protect it, you know, and you know, keep this f keep it alive, and the crew's expendable. This makes perfect sense. It was just, I loved it, man. I loved
And
it.
I do you feel that Ridley Scott was dropping some hints about the fact that Ash might, if not be an android, was not altogether there? Because there was
Oh
something.
yeah. If you watch the movie, yeah, go ahead, man.
Well, like near the beginning, like when the trio goes out into the planet to investigate, and Ash does this weird, like calisthenic
Yeah,
warm up.
exactly. Yep,
Like
exactly.
he jumps up and down a couple of times, and he like shakes his head like kind of like a dog before he sits down, and he like I think exhales kind of theatrically before sitting at his console.
Yeah, it's all stilted. It's all off a little bit. And you're like, what a weird guy. And then it's like, oh, he's not a guy at all.
Yeah, and I also
Goddamn
wanted,
robot.
yeah, it's a goddamn robot. I wanted to bring up a scene, Bill, that I had synapses firing after I watched it, and actually up to this afternoon when I was collating my notes on the movie. It's the scene where Ripley discovers that Ash is the robot, and he goes apeshit. Do
Oh
you
yeah.
feel that there's a lot of like phallic and uterine imagery running through this film as a result of H.R. Giger's design
Yeah,
work.
oh yeah.
And what did you think of that sequence where he goes crazy? Like, what were your thoughts on that? Do you feel like it played into a sort of like a symbol? I have an explanation for.
Okay, well, one, that's cool. I can't wait to hear your explanation, but all I loved how he was like, you know, freaked out and acted so bizarre. But when he's rolling up that magazine, I'm like, he could kill her in like this, just snapping his fingers, but he's doing it this way. And I was just like, even when I first saw it when I was a kid, I was like, what a sick bastard. You know, it's just like, you can't get any more phallic than I'm going to fucking kill you. And that's for real, man. You know, it was just, talk about phallic.
Yeah, because I was like thinking there were a couple different things in that sequence.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like Ash is going crazy. He's got milk, you know, so insert bodily insert bodily discharge here. And the way he rolls up this magazine, which is probably, it's implied, I didn't freeze frame it, but I'm guessing it's probably like a Playboy or something, because there's nudie pics stuck to the wall. So it's like Brett's and Parker's cabin, I guess.
I think it was all Brett's. Brett was the Fox Mulder of the flight.
Porn. So Ripley is like almost like she's kind of knocked out briefly, and she's laying on her back. And there are these nudie pictures in the background. Ash rolls up the magazine like a phallus and tries to, like, I guess, wrench her jaw off with it.
Oh, just shove it down her throat, yeah.
Yeah, and it's really, it was like, man, this is like literally like a porno scene without the porno, basically.
Yeah, talk about a deep throat.
Yeah, and then after Ripley knocks Ash's head off, what happens? There's a geyser of white substance coming out of Ash.
And all over then, Parker.
that too. And then when she jolts him back to life a little later on, what do you see like in the neck cavity? It's like plastic balls and tubing in the neck cavity. So I'm like, Jesus Christ, you're a fucking sick genius, man.
It's a robot penis. They said it's a goddamn robot penis.
He's a goddamn robot penis, man.
Oh, that's.
But it ties into all that weird phallic and uterine imagery that's running throughout the film. The fact that the computer's named Mother.
Oh yeah.
You know, the creator of all things. Conversely, Bill, just as an aside, I love the way Scott films the fake Ash head.
And
then the actual Ash head, it's a seamless transition where I think it's like he films the back of Ripley, so it's concealed, and then when Ripley moves to the left, it's Ian Holm's head, and then when she disconnects him, she gets in front of it briefly, and then it goes back to being the prosthetic head.
You're just reminding me of a thing that like always bugs me is when they're blasting it with the flamethrower. You could tell it's just one plastic piece as it blows the outer skin off. But but still, it's like, you know, for the time, I mean, that was great. The only way to like do it now, you know, do it perfectly would have to be with CGI and, you know, eh.
Well, and there's another thing parallel, Bill, the use of fire to cleanse and destroy things.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And how it's like that you might have to do it to yourself.
Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe he tried to burn it. Maybe he burned himself before it could get to him.
You know, Bill,
we're going to blow up the ship.
Ash has been busy out here all by himself.
I hear strange things.
Yeah. I want to come back inside, okay?
I'm all right now.
Yeah. Whatever happened, I'm much better. Now you gotta let me come back inside, man.
You gotta let me back inside. I got diabetes.
Yeah. Speaking of which, Bill, the only thing that would have made John Carpenter's The Thing better would have been the inclusion of a mischievous cat named Jones. I feel like we cannot address the extra large cat in the room that is Jones the cat. What do you think about the inclusion of a pet aboard the Nostromo? What's Jones's backstory?
Ripley's cat, she was like, you know, she had to have something with her. And it's funny because the ship is so vast, and granted, we don't see like 95% of the ship because it's all like mined ore that's stuffed in like these giant silos and stuff. But
right.
You know, it's like, man, if you're out there work, I mean, what are you going to do? It's like the ship is dull. I mean, it's like, you know, and the people get along so only so well for so long, it seems. Like, you can imagine when they were doing their mining, it's like, dude, when are you putting me to sleep again? Because I hate you people. I got to get out of here, you know? And it's like, oh, right. Hey, look at the kitty, you know? So it's like, you know, I could see that, you know, for all we know, in the future, it'd be good luck to bring a cat aboard. I mean, who knows, you know? It's like, I don't know.
I thought it was interesting, though, because, again, these are questions that didn't occur to me until this last time. Maybe it was because I was in the headspace of us talking about it that I was maybe reading a bit more into it than I normally would. But, you know, I was thinking to myself, where does Jones go in the sleep pod? You know, and at the end of the movie, Ripley is shown, like, putting Jones in the pod, and Jones sort of disappears underneath mm-hmm. the spot where Ripley's feet would be. So maybe he just curls up and goes to sleep, you know, mm-hmm. after she gets in there and closes the pod off.
But how the hell did he get into that locker to begin with, Johnny?
Is he in cahoots with the alien, Bill?
I could actually see the cat closing the door in on himself and being like, ah, fuck. I could see, like,
actually that would be believable, and that is yeah. like totally something a cat would do too.
Yeah, exactly. That's why, like, people are like, well, how'd he get in there, man? A cat can't do that. I'm like, you've never owned or seen a cat, man, because they could do a whole bunch of weird stuff.
Yeah, my one cat used to get behind the refrigerator. She'd be meowing all over I would hear her meowing all through the apartment. I'm like, where the hell are you? You're not in any place I can see you. And I look behind the refrigerator, and there she is. And I start to, like, you know, wriggle the refrigerator out. And it turns out she can just jump up because she can get out on her own. So so anything to make yeah, anything to make the human look like an asshole. But but I was like, I sometimes felt that Ripley was a bad cat mom in this movie. Just letting Jones wander around, and then it's like, you know, Brett is sent off to his death because he's searching for that damn cat. It's like poor Harry Dean Stanton, he's doing the here kitty kitty kitty, and it's like, ah, fuck this shit.
Yeah, fuck this kitty. Fuck this kitty shit. Yeah.
Yeah. I kind of love that's the conceit of the cat, like you said, Bill. It's like, oh, maybe the cat was good luck. And Ripley, obviously, that was something that humanized her character, too.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that it's like she wasn't just an employee on a ship doing this crappy job, you know?
Yeah, it wasn't just, oh, well, fuck the cat. The cat's going to have to just blow up with the ship. No, I'm going to go get my cat because the cat's important to me.
Yeah, exactly. And it's funny because, you know, it's almost like we see her, like, adopting the cat. It's like, was it originally hers? Was it just on the ship begin with, kind of thing? You know, we don't really know. But she was, like, the only one who was really concerned about it, you know. And I guess when it comes down to self-preservation, I don't know, maybe it'd be different. I know I wouldn't be. I'd probably be protective of a little animal, but but I would think, you know, cats are probably our alien overlords, so the cat probably could have spoken to this xenomorph and said, chill out, man. Keep your acid to yourself, bitch.
Well, that's what I was kind of thinking, Bill, wondering if the cat was in cahoots. Just, you know, I'm being jokey here, but, you know, the notion of people thinking, oh, cats are, you know, cats are evil, cats own people, unlike dog owners, you know, dogs, people own dogs, people don't own cats, sort of thing.
We live in harmony with our puppies. You know, something we didn't bring up, and we definitely should, and we are now, that's my damn segue, Jerry Goldsmith.
Yes.
He did the score, and this was one of, other than Star Wars, which I was enthralled with as a kid, this was like the second soundtrack I purchased. I loved the music for this movie, and of course he went on to do so many damn things before he passed on. He has 212 music department credits. You know, he did Total Recall, LA Confidential, Star Trek First Contact. I mean, the list goes on. In fact, his stuff is being used in movies over and over again, even though he's we lost him in 2004. Mm-hmm. The music for this is just really wonderful, and it's very haunting. The opening title sequence is where you see pieces of the letters coming in, and you have this just weird, like, tones. It's very creepy, and the original, the trailer, which I thought was brilliant, the teaser trailer, which they don't make today because Hollywood is fucking stupid. Like, here's a 5-minute trailer, and we're going to give you the whole movie. And, like, that's why I didn't see, what is it, Ma out now with the great Octavia Spencer. It's like, I know what happens. I saw the whole damn movie in a trailer.
Right.
This teaser was great, and it was frightening, and it's like, what the hell am I getting into? And that's what I loved about it. Oddly enough, they kept things very secretive about the film, even though there was this stuff in Starlog about what the landing craft would look like. They had this rover that they were supposed to have driven on the planetoid, but they didn't. So I like had this collection of all of these pictures and stuff from these magazines, which I've since sold. But it was just really cool that even the music, it's classical, of course, but and it's, you could say it's traditional, but he really hits on all the right notes to make it really complimentary to what's going on a screen.
No, I agree with you, Bill. And something that kind of stands out about the score to the film is how varied it is.
Yes, it is.
There's a lot of variety to it. It's not like, you know, no disrespect to John Williams and his, you know, his career. But, you know, you kind of, once you hear the opening notes of a John Williams score, you kind of know what you're in for.
Hard to argue. He's like the Philip Sousa of music scores. Yes.
Yeah, like with his collaborations with Spielberg and such. And, you know, with this Jerry Goldsmith score, I was just kind of like taken aback by it, because there are kind of these discordant moments to it, just these unconventional uses of like a sound and instrumentation, I think,
mm-hmm.
that, you know, of course, add to this really robust, you know, feeling of dread and just this whole sense of isolation and alienation, like you said before. Bill, I wanted to talk about, you know, I think in the years since this film, and I guess in the years since Blade Runner, I guess we could say, Scott has gone from being a very nuanced director who is kind of more, he trusts the viewer to kind of make connections, like in those two movies.
Right.
Without spelling everything out, he has like really become the exact opposite of that.
That's why I said he should never make another Alien movie.
Yeah, his latter day efforts, whether it be the Alien prequels or other stuff, are just like overly explanatory films that are assuming that the audience isn't going to get it unless it's like explicitly spoken by a character, you know, and I would venture to say that viewers are smart enough to pick up on stuff. I mean, television is doing a lot of great stuff with implication and nuance now.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's almost like movies have been dumbed down in general, at least for American audiences, which is sad. I don't get it.
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree with that. But
I know traditionally American audiences hate ambiguous endings, and they hate to read a movie, so they don't want to watch foreign films, which is, and that's not everyone, of course, but that's like the bulk.
Yeah.
So I don't know, man.
Well, I guess I got off on a little sidetrack there, but I wanted to talk about the way Scott does the violence in the film.
Yeah, go ahead, man.
Because something that I think is striking about the violence and makes it more haunting, chilling, horrifying, and just overall effective, even 40 years later, is the fact that it is so brief when it is shown.
And up close.
It's yes, good point.
Very, the shots are very, very tight. They're very intimate.
And it's not like filmmakers today do like a ton of scissor edit close-ups where you can't make out what's happening. These are like, you know, he holds a shot just for like a moment or two, and then the violent thing happens and then it's over.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of like the scene where, you know, Brett gets dragged up into the air duct, apparently.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just a brief moment, but it is so chilling and so effective.
Raining blood.
Yeah, and I mean, it's a real Hellraiser moment because there's fucking chains hanging down for some reason from the ceiling.
They're clanging, it's everything's wet, and
Yeah.
he's taken up into this. I mean, you could do a whole nother sexual thing with all of this too, but
Yeah.
yeah, and it's just yeah, it's just quick and creepy, and even the way he like screams and all, it's just like an it's just like it just it's really profound.
Well, and there was and there's a sequence like near the end of the movie with Lambert
Oh
and
yeah. Get
Parker.
out of the way.
Yeah, and that scene was so effective too because
So
I was actually
distressing.
yeah, and I was actually watching the subtitle watching the film with subtitles, which I always try to do. But I liked how again, you don't really know what happens to Lambert. That's left off camera. You see a close up of the alien grab Parker, and then a close up of the alien opening its mouth to reveal that little mouth inside
Yeah.
as it reaches out and just like, yeah.
Yep.
But you'd only see that for like a split second. You see just a flash of blood, from Parker, and then like after that, I think when Lambert is about to get killed, we cut away to like Ripley. I think she's running down a corridor or something.
Yeah, oh, one of the best screams ever, man.
Yeah, and you hear Parker
Horrible.
screaming, and then you hear
Lambert.
you hear Lambert, and then in the subtitles it said Alien roars, and that was awesome, I thought. It's this otherworldly noise that you cannot I don't know what sound of what animal they distorted to create the alien roar, but my God, it was, I wrote down very effective. Yeah.
Yeah, her death, it's interesting because we see his pointed tail coming up back behind
Yes.
her, and it's like, where's that going? Did it go up into her back? Did it go somewhere else? It's left to the imagination, but the way, with her breathing as she's
Yeah.
like trying to hang on so she doesn't die, but of course she's going to die. It's just, and when she screams and then the alien, it's almost, oh man, I don't want to say orgasmic for the
Oh
alien or anything,
yeah. Well, it
but
is. Yeah.
yeah, oh man. This movie's sick, Johnny. It's a sick movie.
Well, here, okay, Bill. Maybe I can even make it sicker here
Good. Keep going because I'm loving it.
with my thought processes.
You bastard.
Something that I love about this movie, and I know I've said that probably about 10 times tonight, is the way Scott builds up this sense of, keep in mind, this was 1979. This was before kind of the advent of, well, I mean, it was a year after Halloween where it was like, oh, the killer isn't really dead, he's up and about. But it hadn't yet become a cliche. So I feel like when Ripley blew up the ship, people in the theater were probably thinking, okay, that's it.
I know.
That's the
Roll credits.
movie. Yeah, the alien is dead. But then we then we come to her on the aboard the escape pod, and you think, okay, there's going to be a little wrap up here, and then roll credits.
Oh, that, I know. It was awesome.
Yeah, and when she changes it, so she changes into this bizarre outfit that I still think is bizarre to this day. It's like a tank top with a pair of panties that don't quite cover everything.
Right.
And Scott lulls us into this sense of it's finality and
Yeah.
safety with this moment. Okay, Ripley's the sole survivor. It's been a tremendous loss, and she's been through hell, so she gets this. She's allowed to just get ready to go into hypersleep. But no, the alien is stowed away on the craft. The weird thing is, it shoots a hand out at her, and I think I jump every time this happens, even though I know it's going to happen.
Oh yeah.
And she's like, she like throws herself, against the opposite side of the room. She's just like backing up. But the alien is not like pouncing, it's just kind of like cuddled up, all chill and shit. And then it does this bizarre thing while Ripley's like sort of
Oh
terrified.
yeah. Oh
He
God.
does this weird thing that's probably like the equivalent of a guy sending a dick pic today.
Well
It just,
said. Well
yeah,
said.
the alien just like opens its main mouth, and then it just like slowly sticks its little toothy tongue out like it's getting hard.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Well, yes. Yeah.
It needed a rest. It just had sex with Lambert.
Jesus, Bill.
Well, isn't that what we just talked about?
Well, you know what? You got a point there, and it ties into all of the, you know, I'm like wondering who influenced who here. Like, what was the confluence going on with this film? Because it's like you have that one element of the script, and as you know, Bill, the script gets turned into something else by the director.
Oh yeah.
But then, depending on who the director brings in to do set design or costuming or whatever, you bring in fucking H.R. Giger, whose shit is already weirded out to jacked up to 11 on the weird scale.
And highly sexual.
Yeah, like was the Giger sensibility influencing where some of these scenes went? Was it, you know, with like Scott, like thinking, okay, this is how it is in the script, but, you know, maybe it's vague. Let's turn it into this instead. I'm really just kind of.
Go ahead. If Ridley Scott were on with us right now, he might go, "What the hell are you guys talking about?
Yeah,
what are you talking about? I didn't plan." And then it's like he'll look at it and go, "Oh my god, you know, like who knows, man? Who knows?"
Well, and I kind of think to myself, Bill, I wanted this show to kind of be like, I wanted Dennis Paoli, who wrote Reanimator and From Beyond.
Yeah.
He once said, and I often think about this quote, "My job as a screenwriter is not done unless I give the viewer at least one thing they haven't seen before in a movie."
Sounds great to me, man.
And I think with this podcast, I want people to hear things they might not have heard before. Granted, there's been so much writing on this film that perhaps, you know, my observations have been previously stated. And
I never heard of them till today. I love it, Johnny.
So you know, take them for what they're worth. But I those were things that stuck out in a kind of way while I was watching it this time.
Yep. I like that, man. I like it. No, that was great.
Yes. So, I mean, like, you know, Bill, I know you have some things you need to do. What are your final thoughts on Alien? I know we've only scratched the surface of talking about it. There's so much to talk about with it.
Oh, hell yeah. I mean, it's just wonderful. If you love horror where, you know, people are isolated and they have to fight to survive. I mean, you can't get any more isolated than a spaceship, what, 70 million miles plus from home or something like that. Like, what are you going to do? You
know, it's like, yeah, what they said, Bill, when they found out where they were, they said it would take 10 months to get back.
Yeah, 10 months, right. Absolutely 10 months. It's not our system. And yeah, absolutely. So I love the atmosphere. It has the atmosphere of like a haunted house.
Yeah.
And you have this thing that won't leave that went from like looking like a little sea slug to like a 7-foot monster. It's built like a man. It was huge. You know, it's just like... You know, like, how do you fight that? You know, what do you do? What do you do when this thing is an apex predator? And, you know, as Ash says before he goes, you know, you don't understand what you're dealing with. This is the perfect organism, you know?
Yeah.
Doesn't not, you know, I always thought a great name for a band would be Delusions of Morality because, it's, you know, it doesn't, you know, it's not clouded by that. And, you know, you have my sympathies and it's like, you're not going to make it. You can't, you're human, you're puny human. And this thing's just a juggernaut that bleeds acid, you know?
Yeah. And so, Parker's like one hell of a defense mechanism.
Yeah. You dare not kill it. And maybe that's why they didn't use the weapons. Cause it would zap a hole and the thing would, you know, they'd have a breach in a hole or something. I don't know. That's.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that could be a case could be made for that.
But the laser would cauterize the wound. So shut the fuck up, man. No, I'm playing. But it's an excellent film. It still holds up. I think it set a new standard for sci-fi horror. You could see a lot of it in movies such as Crawl or Die, you know, from Oklahoma Ward, you know, starring Nicole M. Alonso, who what I love is just like the Ripley character is she's I'm doing this. I'm tough. I'm going to make it or die trying. But I'm not going to deny that I'm not scared, you know, it's like, and that's what I loved about it. You know, she kept it real, you know, Ripley-esque. So I really enjoyed that.
Yeah, like Ripley, she remains human,
Yeah,
throughout,
exactly.
and vulnerable throughout the film. Yeah.
And that means you could feel for the characters more, you know? It's not, they're not archetypes.
Yeah. No, and something I like about this film, Bill, just, you know, you were talking about the alien and how it changes every time. That was something that I love about the film too, because you think, okay, this spider-like thing that's wrapped around John Hurt's face, oh, okay, well, it died. Well, what happened? You know, then
Right.
something pops out of his chest, you know, in that very famous scene. But then it's like it gets bigger and badder, and you see a little bit more of it each time you see it, which keeps it fresh and surprising every time it pops up. And you don't know when it's going to pop up, so you're constantly getting stung on your ass to when you watch this movie.
Oh yeah, absolutely, man.
And I think that's what's freaking brilliant about it. That's what's brilliant about The Thing as well. It's the more I think about it, the more I think there are these real these would make this would make a good double feature, because
well, I'm with you now. Yeah, totally.
You know it's like these films operate kind of in the same mode, and it makes me wonder if John Carpenter saw Alien and was like thinking, not stealing stuff, but just like, I like what he did, how can I do that in my own way, kind of, you know, in terms of the unpredictable aspect and how things are shot, how locations are shot and everything.
Oh, yeah.
Like that. And how effects work is done too, because both of the films, whereas Ridley Scott's film seems very modest in terms of like the special effects,
mm-hmm.
you know,
yeah.
Carpenter's film is like totally barnstorming in, you know, with all that in your face
yeah,
stuff.
Everything that Botten did, man, he was like working like 24/7 for like weeks on end to make all that stuff rock.
Yeah, now I want to sniff some glue. Now I want to be with you, Rob Bottin. Yeah.
But it's Bottin, not Botten?
Well, I've heard it pronounced both ways.
Oh, man. We got to get him on the show so we could find out how it really is. Pronounced.
This is true, but yeah, I'm with you, Bill. I think we're probably both in very close, if not identical, agreement on our feelings for this movie. It just is, like Ash says, it is, if not a perfect organism, it's a near perfect organism. And that's good enough for me, yeah. I think.
Well, it's 5 stars out of 5 for me, man.
Oh, yeah, I give it a 4.5.
I'll take it. Sounds good to me.
It's probably more like 4.75 if that existed. But yeah.
4.875.
I'm going to be one of those guys who grades it like that.
Oh, man. In any event, I think it's scream out time, buddy.
Well, Bill, in the internet, no one can hear you scream.
That was one of the greatest taglines. Well, you know how, real quick, you know how Dan O'Bannon sold the movie, right?
What do you say? It was Jaws in space.
Jaws in space. That was the pitch session. They're like, we'll take it.
You know what? I think I would rather watch this than Jaws, though.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And on that note, these are people that you could find on Twitter. I'm going to give you their name and their Twitter handle and a little bit about them. And please follow them. They're just awesome souls. First one is Marcus, and he is on Twitter at _hex_13. LGBT, animal lover, photographer, saint, and sinner. And his page may contain adult content. So there's your warning. Yes. Andrew Cameron. And it's under Andrew E.M. Cameron. Comics, video games, movies, politics, science, D&D. Yay! Art, literature, and anything fun. Also, I'm a chef. And he's out of Richmond Hill, Ontario, Canada. Tyler has opinions. Who's that? That's my opinions, man. And if you don't like it, then that's just like your opinion, man. And he's out of Chicago, and he's a blast.
Yep.
Very intelligent soul. Caledonian Roses, and that is also the Twitter handle. I tweet about horror a lot. Thrifting Grandmaster, High Priestess of Paxton, Emily Bronte is my spirit animal, lover of vapid trash, and listening to Nilsson. And she's awesome as well. The Weirdling, and that's under T Weirdling.
Yep.
I read, watch, and listen to too much dark, creepy, weird, spooky, gory horror stuff. This is where my cry for help went to die. You could also follow him on Goodreads. Great, just a blast. Real Jilly G, who is that? That is my sweet sister from another mister. She is a coffee advocate. Fibro warrior with depression and anxiety. And she's just grown and just survived. She's just an amazing spirit because she doesn't fucking quit. And that's beautiful. She's into music, art, writing, reading, horror movies. And she's out of Toronto. Visit her website. It's wonderful. Always engaging. CrimsonQuintessence.com. Another great soul we haven't mentioned in a while. In fact, Sarah and I just reconnected recently, which is fantastic. And that's Sarah Sweets, 83. She's the queen of horror. Ooh, and she's the devil's daughter. Lover of horror and gore, pagan witch, and proud. And she's Bleeding Critics, or actually now From the Clowns, number one fan. And she's into metal music. She loves Slipknot and Iron Maiden. Who doesn't love Maiden? Where is she? She's in your nightmares, Johnny. Famous Monsters. What a great account this is. The first and finest sci-fi, fantasy, and horror pop culture fanzine created by Forrest J. Ackerman in 58. A lot of people don't know it, but Famous Monsters has been on Twitter since 1958. How about that?
Ooh, very ahead of its time, yeah.
Often imitated, damn straight, never duplicated, damn straight again. They're out of Petaluma. And also visit the excellent website, famousmonsters.com. Two more, Josh Stolberg. He's the writer of Piranha 3D, Sorority Row, Good Luck Chuck, the Saw film, Weave World, the CW series, and director of indies like Conception. And he's also a photographer, great soul, cool guy. Follow him, please. And finally, a person that I hope to meet soon with her wonderful husband out, because they're out in Lancaster, PA. That's close enough for me, man.
Yeah.
My Little Rascal 8, who's that? That's Lisa Sorrentino, hubby and wife team making indie films, special effect makeup artist. And Johnny, you recently reviewed their film. What was it, House Call?
House Call, yeah, which is doing the festival circuit right now.
And a lot of festivals. Like, every week she's like, oh, we're in another one. And it's like, and rightfully so. So congratulations to them. And so those are our scream outs. And Johnny, I guess it's we're up.
Okay, well, you know what? My cat just came out of the bedroom, which is kind of ironic.
Wow, how Jonesy of him.
She made an appearance, yeah. So, which means I'm probably going to get dragged out the window by an alien or something, yeah. If you hear the alien roar in captions, that's me. Screaming my last, yeah. You can find me on Twitter and Letterboxd at Johnny Numb. There are no H's in those Johnnies. And you can also find my movie reviews at CrashPalaceProductions.com because Billy is a sweetheart. And Billy, where can people find you?
Oh, wow. Thank you for saying so, Johnny. You could find me on Twitter at Crash Palace. You could also find me at CrashPalaceProductions.com where you'll find links to this show as well as articles from Johnny and Kim McDonald, who I hope to get more from soon. She's Dixie Fairy. We love her. She just wrote an amazing piece on Hereditary. Whether you like the movie or not, her review is just so beautifully well-crafted for Thomas S. Flowers' site, MachineMean.org.
Hey, Bill, not to interrupt you, but you also I wanted to bring up that you wrote a very thorough piece on Alien for Machine Mean Now. Did you want to direct people to that, or did I just do that?
You just did it, Johnny. Thank you. I appreciate it.
I didn't want that to go unsaid.
Yeah. No, thank you. Thank you for that. And I also have a review on Aliens and Why It Sucks on CrashPalaceProductions.com. I take it apart frame by frame, piece by piece. And I mean, if you love it, that's great. But I remember my one friend, I won't mention his name. He read the article. And he said, Bill, I agree with you about all these 8,000 points you have about why the movie's bad, but it's still a great movie. And I just jumped out a window. I tried to end it all, but I was in the basement, so I didn't get too far. But anyway.
No, I imagine you unleashed your alien roar at that moment, Bill.
Yes, I did, Johnny. Arr.
Grr. Arr. Yes. I'm currently watching Angel with my girlfriend.
Yes.
So I'm very familiar with that end.
Yep,
kind of.
Josh, baby. Joss Whedon, man. He just Angel was fantastic. One of the greatest spinoffs of all time.
Yeah, we're still on the first season, and there's like, what, five or six, so
Oh
yeah.
man, you wait. You're not even close to where this thing's gonna go.
No, I'm really looking forward to it because right now I'm like not, it's okay, but I'm not quite hooking, like linking up with
Yeah,
the rhythm.
second season, it's a whole new universe, man.
Okay, that's awesome. Yeah, we're gonna, I'm sure we'll stick with it because it's a bit of a palate cleanser because we're watching Mr. Robot, and we're also watching, we just started the new season of The Handmaid's Tale, so
Oh.
that's like heavy stuff to watch,
Yeah,
so.
I can't even watch that. I'll rip my skin off, so forget it.
Oh, it's very trying to watch that
Yeah,
show.
ooh,
Yeah.
I know. And on that note,
Well, Bill, I say we blow this episode out the goddamn airlock.
sounds good to me.
It's an egg. It's an egg or something.
I see movement.
Good
Good night, Johnny.
night, Bill. See ya.